You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 37 of a series in John's Gospel. Now, if you're joining into this series and you've been listening to the whole series, you'll know that I haven't recorded fresh teaching on John chapters 13 to 17. Instead, what I've done over the last couple of weeks is to release the 10 episodes that were dealing with those chapters from 2014. So back in 2014, I recorded this 10-part series that was looking at John 13 to 17. But now we're coming back into John's Gospel. In this series, I've taught from chapters 1 through to 12. And that's already taken us 36 episodes. But we're now coming back in chapter 18 of John's Gospel. So hopefully that makes some sense, and hopefully if you've listened, you'll not have seen too much difference between 2014 and now. I'm recording this in December 2019, although it will be released in January 2020. So hopefully my voice doesn't sound too much older. Hopefully my theology hasn't weakened in any way. And hopefully what I said in those 10 episodes makes sense and fits within this series. So let's pick up again in chapter 18, verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, Whom do you seek? And they answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am he. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, Whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go. This was to fulfill the word that had been spoken, or that he had spoken. Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? And we'll pause our reading there in verse 11. Now, of course, the pace, I think, will pick up in this series as we reach these chapters which deal with the trial and the death of Jesus, because we're dealing with narrative much more than with teaching. When we look at the teaching of Jesus, we've slowed down and we've looked at that in some detail. But, of course, we can read lengthier passages of narrative and still understand what we're being told. So Jesus has been with his disciples in the upper room, and at some point between chapters 13 to 17, he left the upper room and began his journey. Or perhaps at the end of chapter 17, he started his journey at the beginning of verse 18. So again, it's not clear exactly at what point he left the upper room. But here he goes to the garden, which John tells us is known to his disciples. He often met there with them. We know from other Gospels that it's known as the Garden of Gethsemane. And the other Gospels tell us about Jesus praying in that garden. John doesn't tell us about that. But as we saw in an earlier episode, earlier on in John's Gospel, we see Jesus talking in the same way that he prayed in the other Gospels. So back in chapter 12, when he predicted his death, John 12, verse 27, he says, Now my heart is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. The other Gospels tell us that when he was in Gethsemane, Jesus wrestled before the Father. He prayed intensely. as he wrestled with the reality of what was about to happen to him, the suffering that he would experience and endure. And it's not that John is denying that in any way, he just doesn't focus in on it. But John has made it clear throughout the gospel that Jesus knew that this is where he was heading to. His betrayal and the cross came as no surprise. In fact, his whole public ministry was lived to a timetable that was given by the Father. As we saw at the end of chapter 12, he only spoke the words that the Father gave him. And throughout the gospel, we've seen that he acted and moved and spoke in time with his Father, aware that his life was leading to this point. Well, here he is in the garden with his disciples, and Judas comes with a band of soldiers and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees. This is Judas who has betrayed him. Judas, who John's gospel uniquely tells us had always been dishonest, had been a thief, had been taking from the money bag that was his responsibility to keep as the treasurer of the 12. But here he comes now with these soldiers, with lanterns and torches and weapons. It must have been a frightening sight for the apostles, the other disciples who were with Jesus, to see. But Jesus, who has, if you've followed through the episodes that were from the archive from 2014, or even if you've just read chapter 17, he has just prayed for the disciples. And he's prayed for you and for me too, for those who would believe in him through the message of the apostles. And so he steps forward. Here he is, fulfilling what we're told in verse 9, the word that he spoke in his prayer, of those you have given me, I've lost not one. He stands out. He takes the lead. You've seen it in films, haven't you, from Spartacus, with that famous scene, I'm Spartacus, no, I'm Spartacus, and they all stand up. But it's a common theme in films and stories, isn't it? The person who gives themselves up to save the others, whether they're guilty or not. But here is Jesus doing exactly that. And of course, this is why he has come, to give his life for others, to drink the cup that the Father has given him. Verse 11, he has been obedient through his whole life. Now he will be obedient into death itself. The cup is a phrase that comes from the Old Testament. A number of prophetic passages talk about the cup of God's wrath. Psalm 60 verse 3, Psalm 75 verse 8, Isaiah 51 verse 17 and verse 22, and Jeremiah chapter 25 verse 15 onwards down to verse 16. And I think again later on in, is it chapter 26? So a number of times we read about the cup of God's wrath. This is the cup that Jesus has come to drink. He will take the punishment that ought to have been theirs. At the end of chapter 12, Jesus talked about the punishment that would come. He hadn't come to punish or to judge, but to save. But then on the last day, his words would judge those who reject them. And here he is, making salvation possible by making himself our substitute, standing forward, asking, who are you looking for? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. But look at how Jesus responds. He says, I am he. And the footnote tells you that the Greek simply says, I am. Now that's a double meaning, because on one hand it's simply saying, well, it's me, I'm him, I'm the one you're looking for, that's me, that's my name. But actually, if you've read John's gospel, you know that this phrase I am is loaded with significance. The seven I am sayings, Jesus describing himself as the bread of life and as the light of the world and as the resurrection and the life and as the good shepherd and as the door of the sheep and as the way, the truth and the life in chapter 14, which we haven't commented on in this series, but all of these I am sayings which reveal aspects of the true vine in chapter 15, which again we didn't comment on in this series. But these I am sayings, which reveal both Jesus as the fulfillment of Israel's story, the true faithful Israel, where national Israel, which of course he came from, had been unfaithful, here was a son of Abraham, a descendant of Abraham and of David, who would be faithful. And so the I am sayings identify him as the fulfillment of Israel's story, but they also reveal him to be God. It was God who was the shepherd of Israel. So if the true vine means that Jesus is the true Israel, the good shepherd means that he is the shepherd of Psalm 23. And so here is the one who is both the perfect human being, living a sinless life like no Israelite could, but also fully God incarnate. And so when he says, I am, and we saw it maybe most powerfully of all at the end of John chapter 8, when Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am, at the end of a debate that he had with some of the Jewish religious leaders who wanted to say that they were children of God and children of Abraham, and Jesus says they're children of the devil. And if they had been children of God, they would have recognized who he was. And here he simply says, I am. That name goes right back to Exodus 3. Moses asked God, who will I say has sent me? And God said, say that I am has sent you. It speaks of the utter self-sufficiency of God. It speaks of the eternal nature of God. It speaks of the unchanging faithfulness of God. So much of his character is wrapped up in that word, the one who is and who was and who is to come, the unchanging one. I will be what I will be, some commentators suggest, is a good translation. He is self-sufficient. He's not dependent on anybody else. He's beyond definition. He cannot be limited, but he is unchanging and trustworthy. That's a wonderful juxtaposition of truths, isn't it? On one hand, he's way beyond our comprehension. On the other hand, we can entrust ourselves fully to him because he is reliable. I am. Now, it's unlikely, well, it's possible, of course, that because there was a band of soldiers who may well have been Romans, and then there was a band of officers from the chief priests. So there were some who were presumably Gentiles and others who were very definitely Jews. And their response seems to be different because it says, I am he. They drew back and fell to the ground. Now, again, that might mean that the same group of people drew back and fell to the ground. But it seems likely, and I suggest to you, that it's actually describing the two different groups. The drawing back is a military term. There was something about the way that Jesus spoke, the authority that he spoke with, where these men who were used to being men under authority, taking commands from a commanding officer, saw a power and a dignity and an authority in him where they felt threatened. So they took up a defensive position. They're getting ready to defend themselves, maybe thinking that this was an ambush of some sort. But this man, of course, is not going to fight against them. And so here is Jesus, fully man, revealing himself in this word and the way he spoke it to be a king among men, recognizable to those who knew men of authority and power. But the others, the Jews, fall to the ground, and that seems most likely that they fell prostrate on the ground, on their faces. Why? Because they recognize that this is a declaration of divinity, that Jesus is saying, I am, I'm Yahweh, I'm God. And it's not that they believed him when he said it, but they recognized the blasphemy as they see it, or they interpret it as blasphemy, and they're afraid that God will strike him down, and if they don't show reverence before God, then they too will be struck down. Of course, both of those assumes that there was a an awareness of what they were doing. Perhaps there was just something about the way Jesus spoke that meant that they instinctively responded this way. They couldn't help themselves. But Jesus asks them again, "Who do you seek?" And they say again, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he says, "I told you, I'm he. So if you seek me, let these men go." And it seems like he says it in a different tone or a different way. It's not the stark saying, "I am," but it's a longer sentence. And here he is giving himself so that the others may go free, making sure that none of those that God had entrusted to him would be lost. Sometimes when we think about the disciples in these moments, as Jesus was arrested, we think they were cowardly and they hid. But of course, what Jesus was doing was making sure that they would survive. And in verse 10, we see Peter not as a cowardly person, but as the one amongst the 11 as remained. Judas is there, but he's on the other side now, who has a sword and draws it and strikes the bondservant of the high priest and cuts off his right ear, or possibly part of his ear, his ear lobe, quite possibly. I've heard it suggested that the Greek word really is more likely to refer to the earlobe. I'm not sure how reliable that is, but if it did, then what direction was the sword going in? And that writer suggested that Peter was trying to chop the guy's head off, because it must be a sideways swipe in order to cut the ear. Certainly, it seems likely that he wasn't just trying to cause a minor injury, but Malchus managed to dodge. And of course, it doesn't tell us here, but we know from other Gospels that Jesus healed this man's ear in an act of grace. But what John focuses in on is that Jesus told Peter to put the sword away, that he's going to drink the cup. And so although we might be hard on Peter, who will, of course, shortly deny Jesus, and we can't airbrush over that, but he must have been very confused, mustn't he? Because he tried to defend Jesus and Jesus wouldn't let him. He tried to start the armed conflict that still at this point they thought Jesus might bring in order to make himself king and to restore the kingdom and overthrow the Romans. Undoubtedly, Peter must have thought, well, that his sword would be divinely guided and that few as they were, they would be able to overturn these trained soldiers and begin a revolution. Or maybe he thought the angels of heaven would step in on their side to fight the battle for them. As a little aside, by the way, it's only John who tells us the name of this servant. And that suggests two things. It suggests, first of all, that the readers, John's readers, probably already knew the story about the servant, because John doesn't say about his healing. But it also suggests that they might well have known Malchus, or at least that John did, or somebody did. And if that's true, we have to ask or wonder, don't we, did this guy, this servant of the high priest, come to faith in Jesus when he saw the grace and the dignity of Jesus on this night of betrayal? Let's read on then, verse 12 of chapter 18. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest, but Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I'm not." Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself. Let's read verse 25 and 26 just to finish the story of Peter. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, so they said to him, "You are also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter again denied it, and at once a cock crowed. Here is Peter. Jesus gets arrested. He's taken to Caiaphas and Annas, these men from the high priestly family, and it seems that they took it in turns to be high priests. There was a rotating high priesthood at this point in history, and of course it was hereditary, or at least kept within the family, within those noble families of the Sadducees in the city of Jerusalem. But John leads us on to see Peter, and here is Peter, who had tried to fight for Jesus, who had said he would die for Jesus. Confused he must be, but what takes over at this point is self-protection, isn't it? He does follow close, as does another disciple traditionally understood to be John, in verse 15. But when Jesus, or when Peter is asked, "Are you also one of his disciples?" he said, "No." And a second time, as we've just read, he's asked by a servant, "Are you also one of his disciples?" And he said, "No." And we might only read of two denials here, but three times we know Peter denies Jesus. And what about us? Where are we in this story? Well, of course, we're with the disciples, or we're with Judas, aren't we? We're on one side of that. Are we somebody who has seen Jesus and has rejected him and even betrayed him? Or are we one of those cowering disciples, afraid, confused, lacking in understanding, but watching as Jesus steps forward and allows himself to be taken and refuses to let us die for him, because he will die for us? Here's the one who has come to take our judgment, the one who has come to set us free if we will believe in him. Gaze on him. Look at him. See yourself as Peter, afraid of death, afraid of being exposed, afraid whenever someone who has seen you doing something wrong, that relative of Malchus who said, "Oh, I saw you, weren't you with him in the garden?" But as you hear those accusing voices, look again at Jesus, the one who says, "I will not let go of any of those that the Father has given to me." He's holding you. He died for you. Come back to him. Trust in him and live in the freedom that he brings. Don't live in the accusations that Satan will try to hurl at you, but live with confidence in God.